for Tuesday, April 24, 2007. As you may recall, committee, we have two agendas, a rolled-over agenda that was set for 7 a.m., and I do appreciate nearly full strength here this early hour of the morning. If we complete, well, we'll be going on to the other rest of the agenda no earlier than 8 a.m., because that was noticed for 8 a.m. We will be taking a series of work sessions here in our 7 a.m. agenda, and we'll take them in the order in which they're printed on the notice. So I will open a work session on House Bill 2342.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2342 comes to you at the request of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, expands the crime of providing false information to an officer to include giving false information for the purpose of arrest based on probable cause. You have two sets of amendments in front of you. The dash one and the dash two, they are similar except they both state on line 10 of the printed bill, delete an arrest warrant issued under the authority of ORS. And on line 11, delete 133.110 and 133.120 and insert a warrant. So it would be false information relating to a warrant. And then they differ in the sense that one comes, I believe, from staff, and the other one comes from Ann Christian of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And a section they have, it is a defense to prosecution under this section that A, a person did not know the person was under arrest, or B, the person did not know the person making the arrest was a peace officer. Ann Christian is here. I do not see Kevin Neely from the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
I assume there's no one here on behalf of the district attorneys. Then why don't, Ms. Christian, why don't you come up and describe your perspective on these alternative amendments?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Mr. Chair, this bill, House Bill 2342, I believe was heard in January, and during that period of time, there was a case that was of concern and a bill in Senate Judiciary. The long and the short of it is that the Dash 2 amendments were, in fact, ones that OCDLA wanted at the time. And at this point in time, we would be satisfied with the Dash 1 amendments. I also would like to just put on the record that we anticipated, we being Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers and the ACLU, that line 12 of the bill, the officers arresting the person on the basis of probable cause, would be deleted in the amendments. I have talked with Mr. Neely about that. I did yesterday. Andrea Meyer from the ACLU is out of state, and I did indicate that I would raise this concern, and perhaps it will be addressed on the Senate side. So to recap, OCDLA now is fine with the Dash 1 amendments.
So let me understand. The Dash 2s were generated at OCDLA's request.
That's correct.
But the Dash 1s were in response to, were from the District Attorneys Association, or in response to
our concerns.
Your concerns. Sure. Okay, so but you're fine with the Dash 1s now.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to, but now the one thing I can see right off in the dash is that I had marked just a typographical issue in the original printed bill, going back to our agenda, our hearing back in January, that there's an apostrophe several places where officers, apostrophe S, should be just officers plural. And I'm not seeing that corrected here in the dash ones. Do you have any information on that typographical issue?
Mr. Chair, I remember that being raised during the public hearing, and Mr. Neely is here now, so he may have an idea as well. When I reread it, I read it that the apostrophe S is for the fact the officer is issuing, for example, in line 8, the officer is issuing or serving the person a citation. So it's the abbreviation.
Well, maybe it was intended, because now that I read it again, the purpose of the officers, I'm not enough of a grammarian.
The apostrophe is supposed to be there.
Okay.
But it's really bad grammar.
It's kind of awkward, really, I have to admit, but I think it is intended. I think you're right, Ms. Christian. Mr. Neely, since you're here, why don't you come up and give your perspective, not solely on the apostrophes, but just on where we are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Kevin Neely, Oregon District Attorneys Association. Sorry, I'm a little late. What I can tell you about House Bill 2342 at this point is we have worked with OCDLA on the bill. We're comfortable with the dash ones. And as I believe Ms. Christian said, the remaining issue is around the question of probable cause. The district attorney's position on that is that if you're going to give false information to a police officer, it ought to always be problematic. In fact, there's no scenario in which you ought to be able to lie to a police officer about your name. Ms. Christian reminds me that we'll continue to work with her on the Senate side on the probable cause issue.
I still need to get this sort of back in focus, and forgive me, it's early in the morning here. So the issue that you're continuing to debate is the inserted requirement on line 12, the officers arresting the person on the basis of probable cause. Just trying to understand how that fits into sort of the flow of the bill here.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I could probably give you an example,
please,
as I understand it. So, and Ms. Christian, you can help me if I get crosswise here.
Okay.
As I understand it, the situation is this. If an officer, let's just take a scenario. If an officer shows up at a store, there's a possible shoplift. The officer in that instance thinks the shoplift has occurred, isn't planning on issuing a citation. If the suspect gives a false name to the officer at that point, there's nothing the officer can do. The other scenario, an officer pulls someone over, he's about to issue a citation, he sits down, he starts issuing the citation. In that instance, if the individual gives a false name, then the officer can arrest. And so that's the distinction. We don't see why an officer shouldn't be able to arrest if in the course of investigating an offense, the offender, potential offender, gives a false name versus the time an officer is going to issue a citation. If there's a false name that's given to the officer, that officer then has the authority to arrest. My understanding is that that clause in this bill allows the officer to arrest in that first situation where there may not be a citation issued. There's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, and the potential offender at that point gives false information to the officer. So I hope that helps clarify things, and I don't know, as I said earlier, I think our intent here is anytime you give false information to an officer, there are ramifications down the line, and we ought to try and prevent that behavior.
Thank you. Ms. Christian, when we had our first hearing on this bill a long time ago, both Ms. Meyer from the ACLU and Ms. Alconich from the defense attorneys mentioned something about the possibility of narrowing this to a bench warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And did you address that issue? Because it looks like it applies to bench warrants, arrest warrants, and probation warrants. And I just wondered how that decision was made to leave it as is.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, we did have discussions about amending the bill such that it is amended in the dash one, so that subsection B, rather than being on line 10, rather than being limited to arrest warrants, the subsection B would now read with the amendments, the officers arresting the person on a warrant. So that could be a bench warrant, an arrest warrant, either of them. And that's what, indeed, OCDLA and ACLU wanted with respect to this bill. The issue with the probable cause is I can give an example in a protest case where you have individuals who are engaging in a lawful protest and they are being questioned, let's say, by a police officer, and at some point in time in the police officer's mind, that police officer would say, I had probable cause to arrest Ms. Christian for whatever, trespass. And our concern, and greater even the ACLU's concern, is how do I, as that protester, know that that officer indeed has reached that probable cause point with regard to arresting me, so that I knowingly give a false name, knowing that the police officer has probable cause. I think the best way to explain it is when the police officer arrives at my door and that officer either has a citation, an arrest warrant, or a bench warrant, the officer hands it to me. It's an official paper where I should know that I am going to be arrested. At that point in time, it's my conscious decision to give a false name or to give my true name, as opposed to the probable cause, which is not as clear to the individual being arrested.
I guess the struggle I'm having is that I think I understand the citation and warrant that is dealt with in A and B, because there's a document that reflects the identity of the person who's who's being taken into custody or is the subject of process. The C, I guess, I'm still struggling with a little bit, because I had the impression that that arrest is based on actions that the officer has observed the person committing, and that the getting the correct name of the individual wouldn't necessarily be essential to that action.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that it's the downstream effect of getting the wrong name that's the problem. So what happens is an officer makes an arrest. In the case I described, a potential shoplift, the officer puts that individual in the vehicle, the officer takes the individual down to the station for booking, and the individual gives his brother's name. And now all of a sudden we have his brother's name in our LED system, and the downstream effects of having the brother's name in the system are or could be, for that brother, fairly catastrophic in the long run. And that's a constant problem that officers are facing out there in the street, is they're getting the wrong name, they're booking under the wrong name, and the long-term effects of that are going to be that the individual, and again, it's almost always another family member or an acquaintance, that's the name they hear, a real person who gets stuck in the LED system, and the next time the officer stops that person and runs that person's name, they have this warrant on their, potentially on their record. I think that gets to the issue, and Rep. Barker can.
Yeah, he's covered it. I would say also that, in my experience, probably a good percentage of people give you a false name is because there's a warrant out for them. And if they gave you the right name, you'd run that, you'd have that warrant, and they'd be arrested for that, regardless what the other issue was.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, that's current law, and I agree. And in 2003, I'm pretty sure there was a statute that was passed to better address that situation where a brother gives a brother's name, and the LED system and the court system then needs to be corrected. And we acknowledge that's an issue, but we still have concerns as far as free speech and protest matters, as far as this probable cause provision remaining in the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions of either Ms. Christian or Mr. Neely? Then we're in work session committee. I think I understand what's going on with the dash one amendments. And
Mr. Chair, move dash ones into 2342.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2342. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in the bill. A motion on the bill.
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2342 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2342 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. The only comment I would make, and I appreciate the testimony that we had here from Mr. Neely. Frequently with Hispanic surnames, there's an overuse of, we had once three students that had Jose Luis such and such. I mean, and so the ability to give false names sometimes is really an incredible situation, and I could see how it really messes up the record keeping and the whole process. So mm-hmm. I think this is a good thing.
Very good. If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Hamlin.
Aye. Representative
Kellogg.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2342, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Kahn, would you carry that?
I knew better than to talk. Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2342 and open a work session on House Bill 2895.
House Bill 2895 comes to you from Representative Barker and Representative Thatcher. What the bill does is amends ORA 676260 to require health care providers to more quickly provide notice to law enforcement officials if a patient involved in a motor vehicle accident and believed to have been a driver having a blood alcohol content is in excess of the legal limit. You also have before you the Dash 5 amendments, and they basically require the provider to give such notice to any law enforcement officer who is at the health care facility in official capacity investigating the accident.
Why don't you, Representative? That'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative, House District 28. House Bill 2895 was a work product. We had two bills, 2895 and 2896. We have since withdrawn 2896. And this was a bill that was designed to help law enforcement gather evidence, especially in the drunk driving for drunk drivers from the hospitals. But we had there was issues where the medical professionals couldn't or didn't want to be directed, reasonably so, by a police officer telling them do this, do that, while they were tending to their patients. And so this was a bill that was compromised, worked out. The hospitals are on board with it, and I believe the OMA and the docs are on board, at least in crime victims and the state police. This reduces from 5 days to 3 days to get the answer back. And it will have the hospitals try to get it done as quickly as possible, but not, you know, not immediately if they're doing something else. And so anyway, it was a work, and I appreciate all the work of the OMA and the emergency doctors, the hospitals and crime victims and state police, and especially my legislative assistant, Alan Fleischman, for really working hard to get this bill that could come through here. So thank you. Yes.
Please. Dash 5s on line 5, no more than 72 hours after becoming aware of the results of the blood test. What's the value of it that late?
I'm sorry.
Well, 72 hours later, then you have to notify within 72 hours. What's the value of it?
Well, they would have the blood early, and it would take that long maybe to get it checked before they would notify you. So that you would still be able to, I mean, I would notify you, it might be, I've checked your blood at the time, have your blood at the time, but I can't get it processed for 72 hours or 70 hours. Then I call you and say it was a, you know, 0.08 or. But it's so that the hospital, so you can't say you stop what you're doing and give me this immediately. They can't. They're not able to do that. Thank you.
Any discussion about the bill with the Dash 5 amendments? I guess I have a question here. Looks like the language.
There must be people signed up. Aren't there witnesses signed up? Oh, we're in work session.
Yeah, we're in work session. Yeah, you think there's somebody here who would want to be offering up comments?
Mr. Anderson's here. And
let's have a little discussion. We'll see if it's necessary to go to that. I see the phrase is still in there, who is at the healthcare facility and is acting in an official capacity. In the way you visualize this happening in the original printed bill is there's a law enforcement officer at the hospital, and the hospital then is obligated to inform that law enforcement officer about the drawing of blood, or the fact that blood shows above the individuals above the legal limit. But when it's now 72 hours, I'm just trying to understand how that relates to this phrase, who is at the healthcare facility.
Let's see. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, just the phrasing I was focusing on is at the end of line 10 and beginning of line 11, and so that suggests a situation where the law enforcement officer is physically present at the facility.
Yeah, and then it goes on. If no officer is present at the healthcare facility, starting on line 12.
Okay.
The provider must notify.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, I beg your pardon. I haven't quite pieced that together. So, in other words, the immediately then is has been stricken, but
right.
So there's a requirement of giving notification at the facility, not necessarily immediately.
Yeah.
If the officer is present, and then the next sentence, as you say, is if they're not present, then it's within 72 hours.
Yes. The hospitals express their concern that they don't. I mean, for example, I go to the. They can tell a doctor, do this right now, and the doctor's busy trying to do other care for the patient. And that makes sense that the police shouldn't be directing, you know, medical.
Yeah, I think I understand that. Any further questions or discussion?
Maybe a point of clarification on line 13. We're crossing out provider and inserting facility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to relate to a facility picking up the phone. Who's accountable here, and who would be responsible under the law? The facility, would that be the management, or is that the doctor that took the blood?
Yeah.
Or the nurse that took the blood?
I don't know which individual it would
okay.
be.
Okay.
Members of committee, I assume it would be the corporate entity of the hospital. It's a legal person, even though you're right, it can't... pick up the phone because it's a fiction, but it would be the people who are employed by that facility.
So the hospital is going to have, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I may, so the hospital will have the legal responsibility, the hospital entity will have the legal responsibility to pick up the phone and notify the state police or whoever it says.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, I think I understand how the amendments work now. And we, Jim, Mr. Anderson, I don't know if you don't feel any need to come forward unless you're something you think you need to offer. I'm assuming that your people are okay with the language that are in the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon Chapter, American College of Emergency Physicians, in response to Representative Cameron's last comment, especially about who is in line to take charge of notifying law enforcement. Each individual facility, as outlined in the bill, will have a set of protocols that they will follow under each different circumstance when a accident victim is presented to the emergency department. Protocols kick in. If the facility is the one to report, there will be somebody designated at the facility to follow through on that report.
Thank you. Lipson and Krieger.
Just a comment. I simply went from 6 to 72 hours. If you're border Portland, down at Gold Beach, Brookings, if that person's a non-resident, they can be across the border until last you're going to see them.
I just want to point out that we are actually going from 5 days to 72 hours. The existing law is 5 days, so I think it's improvement over the existing law, maybe not over the original bill.
Any further questions or comments? Okay, do I hear a motion on the dash five amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash five in the House Bill 2895.
Representative Barker moves the dash five amendments in the House Bill 2895. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash five amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2895 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2895 as amended by the dash five amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Cameron. Yes.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisniewski.
Aye.
Chairman Quisenberry.
Aye. House Bill 2895 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass. And Representative Barker, will you carry
yes,
in the floor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on House Bill 2895 and open a work session on House Bill 3026.
Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3026 comes to you from Representative Bruin, Shaufla, Olson, Boone, and Clem, and amends ORS 165-107 to clarify the components of metal purchase record for the purposes of failing to maintain a metal purchase record. Removes criminal component existing crime for failing to maintain the metal purchase record and replaces it with a civil fine. You have the dash three amendments in front of you, and in the staff issue summary, there's a description of them. The amendments, dash three amendments is to focus the background below that in short it uses the term scrap metal dealer and replaces criminal sanctions with a fine. In addition, the dash three amendments delete prior references to repeat property offender statutes and a Class C felony of theft of metal in the first degree. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee, but in lieu of the fact that it no longer carries a criminal penalty, the chair of the committee asked the speaker to remove the prior referral, and the speaker has done so.
This is a little fresher to us, committee, than the other bills, which have been a while and getting back to us since we had this up just the other day. So so we have the newest amendments are the dash threes. Now, do they supersede everything else, or do we have,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they do.
My recollection is we had a set of amendments that were the consensus product of the work group, and then there were a few follow-on items that were identified at the last minute that needed to be cleaned up, which is the reason we didn't work the bill the other day.
I believe we had adopted the dash two amendments. Anybody else have that?
Yeah, I don't have that.
No.
Okay.
I don't think we acted on any amendments. We would need to do that as yet. I see Mr. Stone in the audience. Mr. Stone, can you enlighten us, and is there someone else here who can kind of refresh us? We're moving through a lot of bills, and sometimes we get a little rusty on what happened.
Committee, I'm Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I had the pleasure of leading this task force, this group, through the entire process. You heard from a lot of different folks. I do not believe, Mr. Chair, that you adopted the dash twos. I do have them here, and I do not think that the dash threes are, just from my reading, encompass all of that, but I'm happy to give you my copy of this, but the dash twos and the dash threes have the support of the coalition.
So we are remembering correctly that the dash twos were the product of the work group effort.
Yeah. Yes.
And then the dash threes were what came along following, and I agree with you. It would appear that they do not supersede the dash twos. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm just staffing this bill this morning because Darren Stanford has two young kids and his wife works, and he has to get them to daycare. But when I talked to him last night, he told me that the dash threes were the amendments were the better amendments, and that that's what he has set forth in a staff measure summary. I can't address the difference between the two and the threes, but he said the threes were the latest and the ones the committee should move on.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Flores.
My notes indicate that after we heard this on Friday, the 20th, that there were a few technical changes that needed to be addressed, and the folks were going to get together and bring them back. We had it before us yesterday with the dash threes, as I understand, were the result of that meeting and the technical fixes. So the dash threes should be the ones that probably are the consensus amendments with the technical fixes.
That's my understanding as well.
So we think that the dash, I'm hearing from these sources, everybody here on this side of the dais, is that the dash threes supersede the dash twos.
Correct.
And they should be adopted, and the dash twos should not be adopted. Is that right, Mr. Stone?
Mr. Chair, you are far brighter than I am on most of these measures, but I would...
I'm just concerned because I see a lot more content in the dash... We
were very active in the dash
threes. Well, but I see actually the dash threes are on both sides, so maybe that's the reason. There are five pages of amendments. Do you have the dash three?
I do. Mr. Chair, I would believe that the intent in our discussion with your council... Our discussions with your council would have taken in consideration and made this the amendment to move. So we have great faith in your council to reflect what the work of the work group was.
Mr. Chair, I remember talking with Mr. Stanford about how, for example, Section 2, there was some duplication, and also there was a bit of a difference of opinion on whether this actually increased the presumptive sentence for the metal thief rather than just addressing the person who's buying and selling. And so I'm pretty confident that after talking to Mr. Stanford that this would be, the dash three would be the amendment. And I know he said that when I was talking with him, he had a lot of things crossed out saying this is duplicative, it doesn't need to be part of the bill. So
I do recall that discussion. So,
Chairman of the Committee, if you notice the dash two, I'm looking at page three. It includes criminal statutes in here, and I know the intent here was to take those out and to make it just a violation.
Okay, so it appears that the dash threes are the refined consensus product. Committee.
Chair, I'll move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3026 be adopted.
Representative Cameron moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 3026. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any objection? And the dash three amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3026 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves the House Bill 3026 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Hunt.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lincoln.
Aye.
Chair McCarthy.
Aye. House Bill 3026 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, would you like to carry that?
Sure, if one of our other colleagues that's the sponsor of the bill, but I'd be happy to do it.
We could certainly offer.
It's important to my county.
We've got several people there that could potentially carry it, but why don't we offer it to Representative Olson, since he's one of the sponsors of the bill, if he declines, then we'll come back to you.
Sure.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 3026. Next up in order would be House Bill 3182, but Representative Holvey needs to be here to present on that. So we're going to move on to House Bill 3314. I'll move open a work session on House Bill 3314. We've been trying to reach him or alert him that we're moving along more quickly than I had anticipated.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3314 comes to the committee and the judiciary at the request of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And contrary to the staff measure summary, we are looking at the dash three amendments in front of you. This bill, as amended, also has a probably a minimal
fiscal impact statement, and last night we, you requested that the Speaker remove the prior referral to Ways and Means Committee, and the Speaker's office so assented. And the reason it does that is it changes the penalty from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class A traffic infraction. What it does is it carries, it gives a person, it carries a fine of $12,500, but it gives a person the option of going into a driver improvement program. And over in page 10 is how we set forth how this would be paid for. It's based on the DWI diversion statute. Page 3, section 10. The filing fee paid by defendant at the time of the filing petition for driving improvement agreement is provided in section 5 shall be $237 and should be ordered paid as follows if the petition is allowed. $112 credited and distributed to the obligations payable to the state. $100 treated to provide disposition of fines and costs. $25 will be paid to the Department of Transportation. Now, when I met last night, yesterday after the meeting with the Department of Transportation, and the Bicycle Alliance, one thing I talked about was having the DHS perform that function because they do perform that function as it relates to DWI diversion. But when I talked to Legislative Council's office, they kept telling me that the Driver Improvement Program is run by the Department of Transportation. There's a reason for that. This $25 will go into a fund, and it will be paid. It will help people who cannot afford, who are indigent, to participate in the program. There are constitutional issues there. You cannot have a benefit solely related to your ability to pay for it. So, for example, to get into the program to avoid the $12,050 fine, if I can pay for it and someone else can't, it would be unconstitutional not to allow that other person the opportunity to do so and prohibit them from doing so simply because they couldn't afford it. In addition, the filing fee section, the court shall order the defendant to pay $250 directly to the agency. We have taken the, and then the last section is the driver improvement program fund is created, and it sets forth the process in there. Earlier in the bill, we have amended the bill, so it's the court who makes a decision as to where the what program the person goes to. That's similar to how the DWI diversion provision is handled. The Department of Transportation is no longer required to develop a program. How it's to be operated. That reduces their fiscal impact because they were saying it would cost $60,000 to do that. That's basically the bill, Mr. Chairman. I know there's several people here who...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I missed this, but it's my understanding that the driver improvement program does not exist. So who's going to create it and how are they going to pay for the actual creation of this program?
Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Transportation is here, Representative Bonamici. What I understand is that they certify people. They do not create the program. They certify, for example, if my daughter were to take driver education or if you were to become a commercial truck driver, they certify the people who teach the programs. And my assumption is that these people will have these courses. We talked about this briefly yesterday after the meeting in my office. My assumption is that those courses will be very similar to a driver education course, maybe with some slight twist. But my assumption is that if there is enough of a market, those people will be able to step up and perform a similar function.
Thank you.
Senator Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I still have the same concerns with this bill as I did yesterday. There's no consequences when these accidents are actually caused by the people on the roller skates or skateboards or bicycle operators, where bicycles are both a vulnerable person under this and as a motor vehicle. And I, on the way to work this morning, coming to an intersection, before I got to the Capitol, I stopped. There goes a bicycle right alongside of me, right through the intersection. And that is a daily thing until we get a handle on the operation of motorcycles and hold them accountable. I should have asked the police officer the other day, how many of these people are you citing on skateboards and skates for some type of violation? They're creating a hazard out there. They're on a public highway that's designed for motor vehicles, not for those other type of uses. And to put everybody who's driving a vehicle into a situation like this, I think it's not right.
Representative Krieger, I think under that circumstances that would be a violation of current law. I'm looking at
811-135, careless driving. A person commits the offense of careless driving if the person drives any vehicle. And that's not a motor vehicle, that's a vehicle. That would also include a bike. Arguably, it would include a skateboard.
Yeah, I don't think it includes skateboards or roller skates.
Well, upon a highway. I think we need to sort out two cases here. I mean, there's the issue about when the victim, the injured party, let's use that term, the injured party is on a skateboard or bicycle or anything else. If they are breaking the law or behaving irresponsibly or erratically, then the driver who hits them wouldn't be guilty of careless or reckless driving. So there wouldn't be this statute wouldn't come to apply. Now, it happens that a bicycle is a vehicle under Oregon motor vehicle law. And so if a cyclist were to strike a pedestrian, for example, and kill that pedestrian or cause serious bodily injury, then the cyclist would be subject to this law. That is, they'd either have to pay the large fine or go into the driver improvement program. So it seems to me that it deals with each of those, the irresponsible cyclist doesn't deal with the irresponsible skateboarder, because I don't think that's a vehicle under Oregon's motor vehicle law. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know Mr. Butner came and saw me about this bill quite a while ago, and I said to him at that point in time, if I hit somebody on a bicycle or a skateboard or somebody on a car, in a car, I don't see if I caused personal injury because of my recklessness or whatever. I don't see any difference between those injuries based on my behavior. And today, yesterday, we got to hear, I had to leave early, I apologize, but we got to hear testimony from Lieutenant Mark Kruger from the Portland Police Department, and I put three asterisks by it. It's all road users, not just vulnerable road users, if we're going to come under this law. So I just think we're taking a special class here and setting them aside versus anybody who is injured due to reckless driving. And so I'm still there, and I voiced that opinion from the beginning, and we haven't changed that in this bill yet.
Representative Wisner. Mr. Chair, thank you. And I want to add on to that. I think when Scott talked to me, I was hoping I can support this. As every day I get older, I think we need to include in there, and it doesn't talk about walkers, it doesn't talk about seniors that are using these mobilized scooters and things like that. And I think that's something that if we're going to pass this, that we ought to be definitely protecting the seniors that would be.
Well, Representative Wisnett, I'm looking at Section 2, Sub 1B on line 9 of page 1. Vulnerable user of a public way means a pedestrian, a person riding an animal, or a person operating any of the following on a public way. So
the one thing we talked about, you know, so many seniors you see with these motorized chairs that they have become very popular. That was one thing I was concerned. I'm sorry about the pedestrian, you're right. Do we think that's a concern that we want to add in here if we're going to?
Yeah. The committee, I did hear the lieutenant yesterday who urged that we expand this to extend to people who are inside motor vehicles. My reaction to that is that that there is a special situation for people who are not encased inside a vehicle. They are particularly susceptible to injury, and you see some really grievous injuries caused when just a moment's carelessness on the part of a driver can really be life-altering or ending for a cyclist or a pedestrian. And so I think there's a special need for this protection. Representative Kump.
Chair McPherson, I support this bill. I was particularly touched by line 12 as a farm girl driving. Used to be all tractors were very open and you were very vulnerable, and I can't imagine being in a bicycle alongside the road, because I don't ride one because it scares me to death. But I mean, I used to see tractors run off the road. I just believe that this bill needs to move forward, and I like it.
Very good. And Mr. Chair, I think there could be some improvements, but they have another shot at that on another side, but I think this is a good start, and I'm going to support it.
could we have the sponsor confirm, or maybe he'll look at the senior issues, the people movers?
If that would be reassuring, we certainly could.
Good addition.
Mr. Bricker?
Thank you, Chairman Pearson, members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Scott Bricker. I represent the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. Relating to Representative Wissent, your concerns, we heard those concerns and did request to add actually a couple of other groups when we submitted our amendments that included flaggers, highway workers, and persons on electric personal assisted mobility devices. And those did not make it into the dash 1, 2, or 3s. And we will work on small tweaks. We'll work with council to add those. So we heard that, and we thought that was important. One note for record is that a pedestrian does include someone in a wheelchair, but not necessarily someone in an electric personal mobility device. So we do hope to include that, because we think that's a really important population, especially as population continues to age and we'll see more people on those types of devices. Thank you.
Mr. Bricker, you just mentioned some dash 3 amendments. The highest number I have here in my bill file are the dash 2s.
I have dash 3. I have dash 3. Ah.
I'm behind the game here.
Thank you.
Patty, even hand in gross.
Okay, very good.
Representative, you had to get up too early.
Yes, sir. It's been a long time since I got up to milk those cows, I'll tell you. So there we are. Do I hear a motion on the Representative Flores?
Thank you. Also, Lieutenant Kruger testified yesterday that perhaps there should be additional enhancement for careless driving, and that was a statement that I thought was informative. And then Mr. Evans from ODOT, while ODOT was neutral on the bill, he indicated that the training component adds $60,000, but I see that in your letter to the speaker, do I presume that that is addressed or not addressed?
Well, I think the council, chair members of the committee, that's been taken out of the bill. On page 3 of the bill,
of the
line,
dash 3
between
amendment?
Lines 26 and 29, and the original bill said the driver improvement program should be conducted by the Department of Transportation. That's been changed to the driver improvement program shall be approved by the court. So all it will be is a court saying, I approve that particular driver improvement program.
Follow-up question then. I'm still unclear by your earlier discussion about the driver improvement program. It is in place or it is not in place, and who's going to be setting that up then and the funding to set it up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, from what I understand in my discussions with the Department of Transportation yesterday after the meeting, Mr. Evans, is that they do not create or improve programs. What they do is they license people who teach them. So, for example, as I mentioned earlier, if my daughter were to take a driver improvement program through a high school, what I believe is that person who's teaching that course is licensed by the Department of Transportation. And then our discussions, and Mr. Bricker was at that meeting too, is that the programs, this driver improvement program would be very, very similar to the driver education program that a new driver would take.
So it's contracting out with companies that do driver improvement courses.
Mr. Bricker, Chairman Pearson, if I may, and Representative Flores, there actually are already numerous organizations, private companies, as well as sort of coalitions of folks that offer these types of services. Recently, in Portland, there was a four-hour course created that actually does this kind of education program, but there are also online courses. So, you know, if you're in Portland, the judge would be able to offer, you know, to pull from an array of programs. If you're in Baker City, you might not have access to the same array of programs, but there are online programs, and there really are an array of programs already available. So what we're hoping is that what our intention is to be able to pull from those courses that are already available. That include online courses in places where there may not be any certified traffic safety instructors.
Mr. Chair?
Cameron.
I'm just looking at the hand engrossed that by Patsy, and it says appropriating money, and I'm trying to see where that money is appropriated from. Can somebody help me with that? Or two?
Thank you.
Since we don't have a referral to Ways and Means, is that the way I'm understanding?
Council Taylor.
Members of the committee, Patsy Wood did a hand engrossed based on the dash one or dash two amendments. After the meeting yesterday, after some of the issues that were raised, particularly concerning the Department of Transportation and the language, I sat down with the interested parties, put together some additional amendments to the amendments, and brought them down to Legislative Council's office. We received the amendments back late yesterday afternoon. We did not have a chance to engross the dash three amendments just because of
Very similar,
but they're not exact.
This says with dash three amendments.
Okay.
The one I'm looking at.
And the dash three amendments, Mr. Chair and Council, if you'll look at line two and lines two and three, it does say and appropriating money in the dash three amendments.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that that had been updated, the dash three. I can't tell you about the appropriations.
Here we are.
I can tell you I talked to LFO and the Department of Transportation. Now, the only minimal expense would be the operation of the $25 account. Bookkeeping involved in that.
Mr. Chair, I'm supportive of the intent of this bill. I do have some concerns. I think that one of my concerns goes to the responsibilities of skateboarders, roller skaters, inline skaters, etc. And I'm still unclear, thank you for your assurances, Council, but I'm still unclear about the appropriating money verbiage and if that pertains only to these fees that we're assessing for the driver improvement program.
That would be my understanding, is that the appropriation is because we're charging fees to the people who go into the driver improvement program and then appropriating those dollars to pay for the program. Do I hear a motion on the dash three amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments into House Bill 3026.
Representative Barker moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 3314.
No, wrong one. I'm sorry, 3314.
3314, which is the only bill we're in work session on at the moment. Any further discussion about the dash three amendments? I think we'd like to have a roll call vote on the adoption of the dash three amendments.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye. Representative Cameron. Aye. Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Rieger. No.
Representative
Rieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wintner.
Aye.
Chairman Flores.
Aye.
The dash three amendments are in the bill. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3314 before the due pass.
Barker moves House Bill 3314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
And Mr. Chair, I would hope that the parties would continue to work as it goes to the Senate side to try and get those the things we've identified as problems corrected.
I think people are hearing and nodding in the back of the room.
Mr. Chair, I will be voting no on the bill, and the reason why is because of from day one, I think we need to include all vehicles, everybody who's on the road, and not just carve out a special class. Thank you.
Senator Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if there needs to be a further signal, I will also be voting no so that the Senate will understand that there are some concerns with this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. There is no further discussion?
I'll do the same. I'll vote no, but reserve the right to vote yes if we get this all straightened out.
Okay. Okay. If there's no further discussion, the clerk call the roll.
Representative
Cameron. No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative
Cobb.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wintner.
No.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 3314 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Reed, would you carry that bill?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Very good. Close the work session on House Bill 3314. And open a work session on House Bill 3182.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3182 comes to you from Representative Holvey. The bill creates a task force as a business entity information, increases filing fee, the document filed with the Secretary of State's office.
Representative Holvey, why don't you come forward and describe the amendments and remind us about the background of this bill.
And committee, I was wondering if I could have David Tapman from DCBS come forward with me this morning just for a few minutes
That'd
to help elaborate on this issue. I listened to the committee when I was here last, and I did have some amendments drawn up which eliminate the any reference to increased fees. It seemed to me that that was a message I got. I thought the fees would help create a an ongoing paper trail for to help address this issue, but seeing that I'm maybe out ahead of myself there a little bit, I decided that the committee's advice was good and just work on the task force at trying to address this issue. And if I could get David Tapman to come forward just to elaborate a little bit on the issue from their perspective. DCBS does regulate banks, and the Secretary of State's office was hopefully going to be here too, but I don't know that they've arrived yet to give you some perspective from their side of the government in relationship to ownership of or the minimal ownership information document that I handed out, the testimony that refers to a document back in April that they, that the United States Government Accountability Office came forward with. And it describes basically a situation where companies are being formed with minimal information, and those companies are being used to either shelter income or shelter oftentimes illicit activities, and it's become very difficult for our states and the federal government to basically enforce the illicit activities that are going on around these corporations because they can't find the bad guys. Because we don't have the information on who they are, where they are, and makes it very difficult. So I'd just like to let David Tapman speak for a few minutes, and I hope you accept my amendments to eliminate the fees and create and go ahead and pass this bill and create a task force, because I think it's something the state of Oregon really needs to take a look at.
Before Mr. Tatton comes on, the amendments, is it the dash one amendments that we have? Are they the ones that were?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Tatton.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a division within the Department of Consumer Business Services. As Representative Holvey said, we regulate the financial services industries in Oregon, including banks, credit unions, securities brokers, and mortgage lenders. Within the responsibility of regulating banks, we are charged with, we're one of the few agencies, in addition to the Secretary of State, that's charged with issuing charters and essentially establishing the corporate records for bank companies in Oregon. So if somebody wants to incorporate in Oregon as a bank, they would file a charter with us, and we would be the ones that would grant the charter rather than the Secretary of State. That comes under our banking authority. So we see a number of companies come in periodically that want to start a new bank, and they're legitimate, and ultimately we'll grant that approval. But we also see a number of corporations that use the name bank, trust, bank spelled B-A-N-C, B-A-N-Q-U-E, anything that would infer or imply that they are related to banking. Now, many of those companies, it turns out, are not legitimate Oregon-based banking companies, or in fact are not banking companies at all. But by using that name, it carries a fair amount of cachet or power outside the United States. And our division has received phone calls from all across the world, literally, about people who are doing due diligence in using these bank companies. We've gotten calls, particularly from Europe, Germany, Austria, Holland, but also in the Far East and Australia, where people will be told that there is a bank in Oregon that will be issuing funds or will be guaranteeing a person's investment or something like that, and people will take that as the actual truth, the literal truth, based on the fact that they are using the name, they are incorporated in Oregon and they have the name bank in that. That, in effect, is using Oregon's good name to promote fraud. And we run across that problem far more than you would expect. It may be a reflection on how easily things can be registered in Oregon. We've not heard about this problem in other states, but I wouldn't be surprised if some other states have that problem. In the last 2 years, we have issued 50 cease and desist orders to these companies who are using these names. Now, that doesn't mean they necessarily stop, because they've got them registered with the Secretary of State, and so they can use the fact that they're incorporated in the state of Oregon. But we've put them on notice that it's illegal, and if someone goes to our website, they learn about that. We have an interesting situation here. We've received a letter from the Coast Guard, in which they intercepted a fishing vessel somewhere up in the northern seas, I think around Alaska. And in the course of searching this vessel, they found documentation from a company called Beltalk Holdings, LLC, which was registered in the state of Oregon. And it was registered with the Secretary of State. Now, there was no reason why this fishing vessel, this Russian fishing vessel, would have these documents, because this had something to do with a company that was registered in Oregon. Turns out the holding or the registered agent had given an address of a convenience store in Portland. The convenience store operator was contacted by the Coast Guard to follow us up. Turned out the convenience store didn't know anything about this registration. And when they ran the address, there were several other companies registered to that location. It is such a simple matter to use these, if you will, mail drops, or even use a false address to go ahead and register these companies for all kinds of mischief. The Coast Guard's letter goes on to talk about the individuals who were involved in this, Mr. Fletcher and Mr. Mathias, who are known to us because we do periodic checks. There are a handful of people who use the Oregon corporate registry system, I think, as their manner of business by selling these registrations. To get back to the issue of bank filings, though, we've done a name check within the Secretary of State's database, and since 2006, we find 75 new filings using the name bank, Bancorp, trust, or something related to financial services, which we deem to be an illegal use of the name. And so, ultimately, if we're going to want to try and stop that, we have to take time, use our enforcement powers, issue cease and desist orders, and the like. We don't think that's probably the best use of our limited resources, and our banking division has more important matters, such as going out and conducting bank exams, to handle rather than take time to try and stop these scofflaws. So that's just a small synopsis of what we see within our division, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I can.
Any questions for Mr. Tatton?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, are we in a public hearing or work session?
We are in a work session, but as we often do particularly when we're down to the close of action, we get input, and this is actually a fuller description of the background here that we've gotten, I think, on this bill.
Just a clarification, if I may. You said that there's how many the time period of the using the word bank or bank corp over what period of time, and how many of those?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, since 2006, there have been 75 new filings using a bank or trust or something that implies a financial services corporation.
Follow up if I may.
You may.
And in what entity form were those 75 filings made?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't have that information, but it would either be a corporation or an LLC, limited liability company.
Does this bill deal with C corporations, S corporations, or just limited liability companies?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I'll have to defer to the sponsor. I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you. State Representative Paul Holvey, District 8 again, if I didn't identify myself the first time. This bill deals with all business entity information, so it could be a corporation, could be a LLC, or any other kind of business entity formation.
Just one. So if anybody goes and files a limited liability company or a S corp or C corp with some term of bank on it right now, the Secretary of State's office doesn't flag that, doesn't do anything with it. They just accept it as long as that name has not been used before.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, David Tapman again for the record. The Secretary of State has increased their surveillance in that area. I can't really address how some of these keep getting through. I know we are working pretty closely with them, and we've seen a reduction in the numbers, but 75 is still quite a bit. So I couldn't really answer your question as to how they handle that. But we know that they've made a more concerted effort to try and catch these.
One more, if I may. We brought up banks as being a problem or using the name banks. Is there other specific names of DBAs that seem to be a problem?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, in addition to bank and any variation of the spelling of bank, the word trust is also a problem. And that is even more problematic for us because there are legitimate times when someone would use the word trust. It doesn't necessarily imply a financial service. Some inquiry into those situations would help solve the dilemma, if you will, whether this should be treated as a trust or whether it should be treated as something that should be prohibited. So trust is one of those red flags for us, though.
Mr. Chair, if I might, you know, I don't know if Representative Cameron was speaking outside of the banking community of are there problems in other industries. And I would say from my conversations with Secretary of State's office, they are aware of this problem, much, much vaster problem than just specifically related to the use of the word bank or financial securities. There's a lot of other businesses. And the letter that Mr. Tapman has here from the Department of Homeland Security, United States Coast Guard, with the fishing vessels, deals with other kinds of industries and is very revealing about the problem that is involved, where we have agents that are just creating literally thousands of business entities using various forms. So,
thank you. Love to have a copy of the letter if we may have that. But on the line, I guess this is on page 2, line 7 of the bill. Task force may investigate, above, shall investigate, receive and consider information. Can you maybe describe for us what the investigative process would be of this task force?
Well, clearly, I think that this task force is basically an initial look at the problem to see what we do need to do as far as investigative. I mean, currently, the Secretary of State has the ability to investigate, the Department of Justice does, but this task force is basically designed to bring in the Department of Revenue, DCBS, Secretary of State, and you know, just bring in to talk about this problem and what we could do and where an investigation might go to really get a handle on what's going on out there and potentially what kind of legislation we need to further address the issue.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Representative Holvey, I want to thank you for bringing this. It's interesting because I received a letter at home yesterday, and frequently I don't get down to the bottom of the letter and read the fine print, but it looked very official. It had information about my home mortgage, and I thought I had to do something, make a change, and all it was some company that said this company did. I mean, I had to read the fine print to figure out what the heck this letter was about. And so, I mean, I'm not used to reading fine print to figure, you know, to have to. I just think there's a lot of stuff happening. I call them shenanigans. And I hope that hope this task force does kind of reveal how far these things are going out there so we know what to do.
Mr. Krieger.
Representative Holvey, I have a little bit of concern about there's thousands and thousands of family trusts now that are have to do with inheritance and how they can, and a lot of that is done in that form for the purpose of keeping it private. I would have a concern if we got into that realm of these small ones. I can understand the bigger ones, but I don't think you'd know that until they were looked at. Can you address to that issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, you're absolutely correct in identifying that as one of the problems with going this direction. Privacy is certainly a concern that we need to be aware of and needs to be handled appropriately. I think that's why this task force is so broad with the Oregon State Bar and, you know, some others that are participating in this to really take a look at, you know, how can we address this and still protect the privacy of many of our legitimate individual citizens who, you know, have formed corporations. It's not the intent of this bill to invade someone's privacy as such, but I think that our state agencies are able to look at the information around this without divulging private information. But clearly to identify, you know, fraudulent activity using, you know, shell business entities. And the Secretary, someone from the Secretary of State's office just showed up, and I think they might have some testimony that might be quite pertinent.
Should we get these questions first?
A quick follow-up. I can see the need for it. I think that when the task force makes some recommendations, they've got to be careful that they don't set up a system for administrative rule with somebody, that pretty soon, you know, a lot of the safeguards of privacy and the reason for it is jeopardized.
I share your concern, and I would expect this task force to report back to the legislature, to this body, to, you know, to really have a further discussion about the privacy issues. But I do think that this issue and the amount of potential illicit activities that are going on using the state of Oregon's registry system to create companies without any scrutiny, or it really does need to be addressed, and I think we can address it and still protect privacy of legitimate interests that are involved in LLCs or corporations or other kinds of business entities.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think, Representative Holley, I'm in concurrence with the purpose of your bill is to try to track those who are trying to engage in illicit activity and create shell companies for purposes none other than to do significant, what was your term?
Shenanigans.
Level of frustration, Mr. Chair, in that we are in work session, not public hearing, and I am very anxious to hear from the Secretary of State's office as to what their current practice is. Obviously, it's some level of cursory review and not the depth, perhaps, that is needed, and would like to know what they do, what they knew, when they knew it, and how and why those things aren't explored to a greater degree.
Thank you, Representative. And we are in work session. We've been getting quite a bit of input on this bill, which I think is useful to us. Just would urge people that we've got to still have a long agenda yet to go. We are nearly through with our 7 o'clock agenda, and then we'll be taking up our 8 a.m. agenda. But let's do hear from the Secretary of State's office about the background that they can bring, since they, under the terms of the bill, would be required to staff this task force.
For the record, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. This is an issue that we've had some involvement in for quite some time. We've worked very closely with the local office of the FBI and the Attorney General's office, and David's folks in the Banking Regulators Division. And it's not just an Oregon issue, it's a national issue. Congress has held hearings, as you're aware, this last fall to look into how we as states can better get a handle on this particular problem. And just to really set the scope of the problem, what we have is a situation where foreign individuals have determined that they can come to the United States and they can file. Primarily, it's limited liability companies. They're not, and they're organizing those companies here under Oregon law, under Wyoming law, Oklahoma law, whichever state that they happen to choose to do business under. And then what they particularly do is they avoid setting up any type of an office here. They don't have employees. They don't have any physical presence in the state. Basically, they just get the formation done in the state. They get a document from the Secretary of State, generally an apostille or an authentication that they can take to any other country in the world, and then they go about with the credibility of having a U.S. company. And so then they're able to go and transact all kinds of business, open bank accounts, and move goods across borders. What they typically try to avoid doing is, again, having any presence in the United States, because then they avoid any type of jurisdiction from U.S. legal authorities. So really what's happening is they're setting this up so that they can conduct their illicit activities overseas. Then other worldwide regulatory or law enforcement agencies come back to the FBI and other agencies in the U.S., it winds up being a dead end as far as trying to track down who these different individuals are that may be the beneficiary owners or the primary operators of these companies. But that's specifically, I think, why these individuals try to set them up that way. So the task force would look at what type of information Oregon in particular needs to collect and ask for in organization documents and annual reports. Currently, with a lot of our organization documents, we ask for an incorporator, we ask for an organizer, and a registered agent, but that the incorporator or the organizer isn't necessarily an owner, and that's currently set by statute. A lot of times when you're starting a new company, you may not have directors, you may not have officers, and you may not know, you know, you're still in the formation process. A year later, when the annual report's due, is when we ask for that information, and that's required to be reported. But it's taken on faith, and it's taken at face value. There's not any type of a check back to whether it's a national ID directory or DMV directory or anything like that to have that assertion that it is a real person behind that. And that is one of the things that's in the system that we think needs to be looked at. But at the same time, we want to make sure that for the 99.9% of honest businessmen in Oregon and business owners, that we're not creating unnecessary high burdensome process for them to catch this and to prevent the small minority of criminal activity that's using our system from overseas.
Mr. Thurkell, the bill provides that the expenses of the task force staff support would be provided out of funds appropriated to the office by the Secretary of State's office. Do you foresee any difficulty providing that support?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Okay. Well, committee, I think Representative Compton.
Are you ready for a motion?
Well, I am. I'll just hear from Representative Flores's question or comment here.
Thank you. It is a question, Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thrawkell, you indicated that the information that the National ID Directory, FBI Directory, you don't have the capability currently to make that check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I guess the directory would be some sort of a citizen directory or a directory of individuals, whether it was a citizen database of some sort. That's not anything that's checked against. No, we don't have that that type of capability today. I don't know if I'm not sure which type of a directory would really even be the best source for that type of information.
Just quick follow up. I get your eye message. I was using the phrases that you had used, check that to a national ID or a FBI directory. So do you not have the scope of authority to make this check now or check on information that you receive when these filings are made?
I believe we do not. We're set up as a ministerial agency. And if the information is, if the forms are filled out correctly and the information appears to be there, then beyond that would be more of a voluntary type of an action. I think we could do it. The problem is it becomes, you know, a classic example of if Osama bin Laden wanted to form an Oregon corporation, he's entirely free to do so. There's not a law that says he can't.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Comp?
Chair McPherson, I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3182.
Representative Comp moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3182. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Chair McPherson, I move House Bill 3182 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Trump moves House Bill 3182 as amended to the floor with a if we could ask you to modify your motion,
yes.
Which is to and request that the Speaker's office rescind the prior referral to revenue because that was there only because of the fee increase. I'm quite confident, only there because of the fee increase that was in the original bill. Representative Flores, you're
just a quick check, Mr. Chair. Task force creations, they do have some level because of staffing and so on, and reimbursements for expenses. So where does that fall in the scheme of things?
Representative Flores, good question to ask, although that was the reason I asked Mr. Threlkeld, because the bill says that these claims for expenses should be paid out of funds appropriated to the Office of the Secretary of State for that purpose.
Very well. But in the context of task forces do incur money, they feel that they currently can do it by reallocating resources within their current budget. But I then would like to be assured that they're not going to be coming back at the e-board or whatever and saying, well, you know, you asked us to do this and we don't have the money for it.
Mr. Threlkeld, hear this. Will you folks need any more money appropriated to you to be able to provide this function?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, my understanding is if a fiscal impact is going to be under $25,000, there's really no need to file that. We would just absorb or be expected to absorb that kind of that amount of money. So we will not come back and ask for more money. You know, we don't expect that. You know, we're not going to take on the role of the FBI and do those levels of investigations. We're going to be working with the group and the community and the Oregon Bar Association to basically come back with recommendations for what information should be collected. So there are a little more background. American Bankers Association currently has two task forces looking into this issue. National Secretary of State has a task force looking into this issue. So there's a number of people looking into and organizations looking at it, and Congress is looking at it as well. So I mean, I think there's some other information that we can draw on and that we can come back and that, you know, will help in recommendations that come back that the task force will make to the legislature.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
I talked with Representative Holby on the floor about this the other day. I think it's really important, and I appreciate you coming here and talking about the 99.9% of businesses that are legitimate. I think it's really important when you appoint this task force that you have some of those legitimate businesses represented and not just this government entities that are on here. So appreciate that.
We have a motion that was being formulated, yes. And I think that to state what I think the motion is, making, Representative Comp, it is to move House Bill 3182, due pass, as amended, with a due pass recommendation, and to request the Speaker's office to rescind the prior referral to revenue.
Yes, that's my motion, Chair.
Very good. Any further discussion of that motion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores. Cautious, aye. Representative
aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wissett.
Aye.
Chairman
Forsyth. Aye. House Bill 3182, as amended, moves with a due pass recommendation with a request for rescinding of the prior referral to Revenue Committee. And Representative Holby, will you carry that on the floor?
Sure. I say that reluctantly. I'd rather have him carry it, but I'd be happy.
Press him to come and sit with you on the floor.
We'll have lots of questions.
I'll close the work session at House Bill 3182. That concludes our 7 a.m. agenda. We are now going to take up our 8 a.m. agenda, and let me just roadmap that a little bit for those who are present. We have a lot of business yet to conduct today. We have three bills set for public hearing, House Bill 2415, 3319, and 2381. However, House Bill 2381 will not be heard. I'm instructed that we are to gavel out of the 7 a.m. meeting, so that meeting is now closed. We'll change the tape and then gavel in the 8 a.m. meeting.